At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. Whether it's a walk-off grand slam or a base hit to center field. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment. It's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Last season on the Choosing Sides F1 podcast, we established unequivocally that F1 is the pinnacle of motorsports.
We did, but honestly, I was left with more questions than answers, Tony.
I'm Tony Karen Brown, a tech, culture, and F1 commentator.
And I'm Michael Costa, comedian from The Daily Show.
Join us for season 2 of Choosing Sides F1.
Our F1 102, if you will.
And get all of the answers.
All of them? Listen to Choosing Sides F1 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts,
or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Countdown with Keith Olbermann is a production of iHeartRadio.
Here before me at the Trump rally, in front of Trump Tower in New York City, teams a vast multitude, as far as the eye can see. Millions and millions of patriots rallying for Trump at his Monday evening rush hour rally in New York City. The number is literally uncountable. And when I say uncountable, I mean, let me count them. One, two. There's two people here. As my cousin Mike Tyson says, everybody's got a plan until they get punched in the mouth, and these people just got punched in the mouth. Two guys at the rally. Still, could be worse. They could be rallying in the parking lot of an In-N-Out Burger in Laguna Hills, California. Two people. Oh, the humanity.
Thanks, Keith. Great report. Kind of wish I was kidding about that rally at Trump Tower drawing two people, or the one downtown by the New York Young Republicans at the federal courthouse drawing an estimated 22 people and 100 reporters, or the part about that In-N-Out Burger in Laguna Hills, California, because Roger Stone says that's where today's Trump rally actually is, in the parking lot off exit 91 of the 5 freeway. And a reminder, that In-N-Out has no drive-through. This is four seasons total landscaping all over again, but it's as if there was a four seasons total landscaping and a new Rudy Giuliani in every American city making a fool out of himself and Trump and their cult again and again and again. And now it's the Simpsons meme. Stop, stop, he's already dead. And the full-fledged right-wing, insane, headless chicken, this can't happen, I've never really seen one, but that's got all the earmarks of being a run-on-the-bank panic by Trump and the gang, continues, uninterrupted and unrelieved, and it will continue through today at least and into tomorrow, because the Stormy Daniels grand jury has the day off today. And this is the most fun I've had in like 2 years. And while Politico reported that there could be an indictment and arrest of Trump tomorrow because the grand jury really is off today, CNN quoted a person close to the Trump team, who I'm thinking could easily be CNN's new owner, who says they aren't expecting any initial appearance by Trump, arraignment, arrest, mugshot, but no perp walk, repeating, there will be no perp walk. The Trump team is not expecting even the first hurdle to happen before next week. Then again, the CNN reporter on this is Paula Reed, who earlier yesterday said Trump was showing restraint because he had only called for violence in some of his social media posts. And then, of course, Trump promptly insisted that when there's violence in New York, the police should not defend any victims if they're anti-Trump, but support the thugs. The only restraint Trump should be showing is a straitjacket. It is amazing that after all this time, 8 years in politics and 40 plus years in public life, people still step on the same Trumpian rake again and again. Oh, he hasn't said something stupid or threatened something stupid or promised something stupid in the last 10, 12 hours, so he clearly never will do so again. Not only did this Reid from CNN fall for it, but Kevin McCarthy fell for it again. McCarthy said if Trump's arrested, he, McCarthy, believes there should not be protests. And, quote, I think Trump, if you talk to him, he doesn't believe that either. And, of course, hours later, Trump went back onto social media to claim he was being persecuted by the radical left, communist, Marxist, rhinos, and losers. And he first posted a message implying that Ron DeSantis was a pedophile or gay, and then deleted that message. And then within the hour posted a new version of that message showing an image of DeSantis with seemingly underage girls. And it was then that Donald Trump finally became president. His supporters spent Monday, as they spent Sunday, as they spent Saturday, as they will spend each day until mugshotmas, making the proverbial unforced errors. Whatever Trump's attorney Robert J. Costello said to try to impeach Michael Cohen at the grand jury in New York yesterday was not enough to even make the grand jury call Cohen to rebut, even though Cohen was sitting outside in the hallway. After Speaker McCarthy bordered on obstruction of justice twice on Sunday by threatening to cut off federal funding to the Manhattan District Attorney's office, three of his sleaziest lieutenants, Jim Jordan, Jamie Comer, and Brian, I actually work for Fox, Style, wrote Bragg requesting documents and testimony with no apparent awareness that D.A. Bragg can ignore them because not only would a Biden Justice Department never enforce a contempt of Congress complaint against him, even if they somehow got the votes in the House, but a Republican department would hesitate to interfere with another prosecutor and a prosecution already in progress. While DeSantis triggered Trump by laughing as he said, quote, I don't know what goes into paying hush money to a porn star, the dumbest remark still had to have come from New York Congresswoman Claudia Tenney. Tenney told Newsmax, quote, I think this is all going to blow over because I don't see any way that they're actually going to get Donald Trump to appear in a court for indictment or any type of charge. So I think, again, this is grandstanding. Tenney was so magnificently wrong about this that even the Newsmax hosts had to gently explain to her that the day Trump said he was going to be arrested, he also said he would show up in court. This is not going to just blow over. Meanwhile, on the arrest Trump while we still can and when he's been arrested, arrest Trump again front, his Georgia attorneys threw a Hail Mary, asking that the entire Fulton County grand jury report be quashed, erased legally. You never know about this stuff, but it seems unlikely to happen, given that at exactly the same time, the Fulton County prosecutors were asking to interview one of Trump's non-Georgia attorneys, the infamous Christina Bob. And in the case of the company that may go bankrupt because they defamed on Trump's behalf, Fox, quote, News, unquote, and Dominion Voting Systems go into their Delaware courtroom today, having each asked the judge for summary judgment. In other words, claiming that the other side is so incredibly guilty that there is no need to bother with a trial, so just find against them now. While rumors flew that Fox may settle, and remember, Dominion sued for $1.6 billion in damages, while the next suit by Smartmatic is for $2.7 billion, the entire case went crazy last night. Somebody leaked that Abby Grossberg, former producer for Maria Bartiromo and now guest booker for Tucker Carlson, is suing her employers at Fox. She has accused Fox's lawyers of, in essence, setting her up, of coercing her into giving misleading testimony in the Dominion lawsuit. She's also sued them for gender discrimination. And Fox has in turn sued her to keep her from talking about what the attorneys talked to her about. But she has already talked, and not just about the attorneys. Grossberg says that Fox bosses called Maria Bartiromo a, quote, crazy bitch, unquote, and, quote, menopausal, unquote. She also says when she switched over to Tucker Carlson's show, Carlson's top producer Justin Wells asked her if Bartiromo was having an affair with Kevin McCarthy. The world answers ew. Later, Grossberg claims, quoting the New York Times, Mr. Carlson's staff joked about Jews and freely deployed a vulgar term for women. She says that before Michigan Republican governor candidate Tudor Dixon was interviewed on Carlson's show, the, quote, staff held a mock debate about whether they would prefer to have sex with Ms. Dixon or her Democratic opponent, Governor Gretchen Whitmer, unquote. Huh. All this lines up with how Tucker Carlson behaved at MSNBC. Anyway, three final thoughts. One, Mike Tyson really is my cousin. The line about everybody has a plan till they get hit in the mouth. He was adopted by his first boxing manager, Cus D'Amato, and Cus's niece, Geraldine. Jerry was married to my uncle. She was my Aunt Jerry. By marriage and adoption, Mike Tyson and I are cousins. Okay, two, the impeccable Julia Davis, who monitors Russian TV for the Daily Beast, quotes a commentator there as saying, translated, it's possible that our Donald Fredovich Trump might end up in the slammer, to which George Conway added the helpful note that Fredovich means son of Fred, a common Russian usage, so Trump's name in Russia is Donald, son of Fred. But of course, let me add that you could pronounce that name differently, and suddenly he's Donald Fredovich. And three, bad news for him, you know, about the alleged anti-Semitism in Tucker Carlson's office and the whole Bartiromo-Kevin McCarthy question. On the other hand, Rupert Murdoch is getting married again. Her name is Anne Leslie Smith, and this time, it's for life. Rupert is 92 years old. It's the thought that counts. Still ahead of us in this edition of Countdown, 20 years since we attacked Iraq, and I actually heard a BBC interview ask the other day if overall it had turned out to be a good thing. It was during the Iraq War and George W. Bush's compulsive lying about the Iraq War that I first became a true political commentator. I would like to read you some of the anti-war commentary I gave, not during the war, but before it, in 2002 and early 2003. And then, if you'll indulge me, the backstory to the first ever special comment, the one about Donald Rumsfeld's moral and ethical confusion speech, and the comment itself. And then in Things I Promised Not to Tell, sometimes life throws you into the deep end of the pool. On July 2nd, 1979, I was a fan cheering Thurman Munson from the stands at Yankee Stadium. On August 2nd, 1979, I was a reporter covering the shocking news that Munson had died piloting his own private plane. A story that broke 2 minutes before my first sportscast. That's next. This is Countdown.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. See for yourself when you sign up today and get $150 in bonus bets when you bet just $5. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply.
Last season on the Choosing Sides F1 podcast, we established unequivocally that F1 is the pinnacle of motorsports.
Lily Herman, my co-host in season one, helped me choose a team, a driver, and then...
Well, we sent you on your jolly way.
Yeah.
I'm Tony Karen Brown, a tech, culture, and F1 commentator.
I'm Michael Costa, comedian, Daily Show correspondent.
And we're back with season two because, as it turns out, F1's newest fan is still a little...
dazed and confused.
Join us for season two of Choosing Sides F1 as we dive deeper into the rabbit hole of the pinnacle of motorsports.
Who makes money here?
What's CFD?
How do you manage a tire?
You, get back in there.
What are the rumors? What's the gossip? But you also know that someone's listening to your radio.
I'm going to pull up a picture of a tea cozy. I want to see what this thing looks like.
Are you going to be doing that accent this whole pod?
Listen to season 2 of Choosing Sides F1 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts,
or wherever you get your podcasts. You find it.
I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
You've been looking for me, yeah?
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
These are the tales that shaped the nation.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
Then I told them they were drinking cyanide.
Featuring the voices of Wes Studi.
At least 4,000 people died on the trail.
Martin Starr.
President Nixon called me the most dangerous man in America.
Scott Hayes.
Next thing I know, I'm standing over the bodies of Baker Morton. My pistol smoking in my hand.
And Tristan Mack Wilds.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
Starring Dan Fogler as the ferryman.
This is The Passage.
Listen to The Passage now on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Something different today because it is now 20 years since this country attacked Iraq on what we now know was cherry-picked, falsified, dishonest, corrupt, manufactured evidence about weapons of mass destruction that did not exist. For nearly 6 years, the President of the United States insisted those weapons did exist, and his cult insisted they did exist. And there are some who at worst today think of George W. Bush as benign in the context of Trump, who still believe they exist. There is also now a lot of dismissal of liberal media types who let Iraq happen. It's an absolutely valid criticism, but it requires context. I was anchoring on CNN as U.S. troops landed in Afghanistan that night, and I was anchoring on MSNBC as they landed in Iraq to fight against a presidential administration that could end careers by simply saying this senator, this reporter, this American is not tough enough on terrorism meant accepting and fighting threats, threats to your job, your livelihood, even your life. Not everybody could face all three. I'm happy to say circumstances permitted me to, but a few twists and turns the other way, and it might have been different. I might have been afraid. I might have had a mortgage. I did a daily radio commentary for ABC News in 2002 and 2003, in addition to the CNN work. And on October 28, 2002, as Bush began to push for a war he had planned for Iraq long before 9/11 occurred, I said that before we gave in to Bush, we needed to present all the evidence we had as a country to the United Nations, the way John F. Kennedy had done so through the ambassador, Adlai Stevenson, during the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962. Little did I know that when they finally did that, they would use fake evidence and send Colin Powell there to pretend it was not a lie. On January 29, 2003, I expanded on this idea of the necessity of evidence made public at the UN, quoting from my script for the ABC show. It's got to be more than just a proof that Iraq had or has anthrax. Many of our allies had or have anthrax. We have or had anthrax. Draw us a map, Mr. President. The idea that these weapons aren't just part of the madness of Saddam Hussein, but are being provided to the far graver threats, the terrorists, has to be established. Mr. Bush said that America's purpose is more than to follow a process, it is to achieve a result. But that's not true. That's not this country. We are about both the process and the result. We are not our enemies. Powell's speech to the United Nations has to be so much about process that all doubts are erased. By March 7th, 2 weeks before we started bombing, I said something on ABC that got me called in by management. Quote, I think President Bush really doesn't know what he's doing. If there has been a more lackluster public performance at a news conference by an American president than Mr. Bush's last night, I cannot recall it. He sounded like a talking doll. Pull its string, and it gives you one of a couple of answers, sometimes the same one over and over again. It is not enough to smirk at the people who disagree with you, Mr. President. It is not enough to look at the rest of us like we were too stupid to understand you, so you're not going to bother to explain it to us. That was not leadership by chief executive or irritant media. That was getting a roll of stamps and mailing it in. On March 23rd, 2003, just 20 years ago, and I was on MSNBC again by this point, a supply clerk with a maintenance company on the ground in Iraq was captured by the Iraqis, Private Jessica Lynch. The military and the Bush administration immediately put out a story that she was being tortured by evil Iraqi Saddam Hussein doctors. Then, on April 1st, there was the glorious rescue of Jessica Lynch and the parades and the "you better not question this story" mandates from management at MSNBC, which lasted at MSNBC and elsewhere about 6 weeks, until a newspaper in Toronto printed a different account of how Jessica Lynch returned to American hands. It was that Lynch was rescued from an Iraqi hospital and a U.S. military team in good faith went to extract her, but that this was all arranged by the Iraqi doctors, one of whom sneaked over to the American lines at night and said, "Listen, one of your soldiers is hurt and we don't have the right equipment to help her. Could you swing by and pick her up?" I reported that version on MSNBC, quoting the Toronto paper virtually word for word, and the next day, my boss, Phil Griffin, called me in and said that the head of NBC News and the NBC president, Bob Wright, the president of the network, had been on the phone all morning insisting I should be fired immediately for implying that the Bush administration had lied. Griffin proudly said he had talked them into letting me get away with apologizing. Apologizing to the troops who rescued her. I have to say, despite my reputation for flying off the handle, I did some very good and very quick thinking. The demand was comical nonsense, journalistically. On the other hand, if I agreed to apologize to the troops who rescued her, I would get the chance to tell the real Jessica Lynch story again that night. So I did. The apology was 15 seconds, and while unnecessary, was sincere in my admiration for the troops. I made sure that the retelling of the true Lynch rescue story that followed took 2 minutes and 15 seconds. Over the next 3 years, I took every opportunity I could to criticize the war and Bush and how he had lied us into it, but always in small doses, in little asides, in two-minute readers, in questions to guests. And then it got a little longer, a few pieces here and there, a few brief 2 or 3 minute commentaries, but the self-censorship of the time by most major media outlets in this country was infuriating. And then came the night I decided I didn't care anymore. On August 29th, 2006, a flight I was taking from Los Angeles back to New York was delayed. And as we sat on the tarmac at LAX, I read, and I read it for the first time, I think, in my life, I read a news story on my phone, and it was about the then Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, saying about how any of us who disagreed with the Bush administration's policy in Iraq, or indeed just disagreed with the Bush administration itself, were morally or intellectually confused. Well, this pissed me off. Our takeoff kept getting pushed back and back. The drinks in first class kept getting pushed forward and forward. And my ire kept getting pushed up and up. And so I took the few pages of my trip itinerary and scratched out what turned out to be a very, very long commentary, which I figured I'll read on MSNBC and then they'll fire me. I aired it the next night and I fully expected they would fire me, or somebody would throw me in the back of a car or in the trunk of a car, perhaps, or I'd wind up at Gitmo, or all of the above. If you don't mind, I'd like to read that commentary, handwritten, as it ran on MSNBC on August 30th, 2006. We needed a graphic to indicate that this was a commentary, just my opinion, and I wanted to emphasize that this commentary was just going to be a one-shot thing, so I just threw out a title, and they made it into a graphic. So I said, call it a comment. Call it a special comment. The man who sees absolutes where all other men see nuances and shades of meaning is either a prophet or a quack. Donald S. Rumsfeld is not a prophet. Mr. Rumsfeld's remarkable comments to the veterans of foreign wars yesterday demand the deep analysis and the sober contemplation of every American. For they do not merely serve to impugn the morality or intelligence, indeed the loyalty, of the majority of Americans who oppose the transient occupants of the highest offices in the land. Worse still, they credit those same transient occupants, our employees, with total omniscience, a total omniscience which neither common sense nor this administration's track record at home or abroad suggests they deserve. Dissent and disagreement with government is the life's blood of human freedom, and not merely because it is the first roadblock against the kind of tyranny the men Mr. Rumsfeld likes to think of as his troops still fight this very evening in Iraq. It is also essential, because just every once in a while, it is right, and the power to which it speaks is wrong. In a small irony, however, Mr. Rumsfeld's speechwriter was adroit in evoking the memory of the appeasement of the Nazis. For in their time, there was another government faced with true peril, with a growing evil, powerful and remorseless. That government, like Mr. Rumsfeld's, had a monopoly on all the facts. It, too, had the secret information. It alone had the true picture of the threat. It, too, dismissed and insulted its critics in terms like Mr. Rumsfeld's, questioning their intellect and their morality. That government was England's in the 1930s. It knew Hitler posed no true threat to Europe, let alone England. It knew Germany was not rearming in violation of all treaties and accords. It knew that the hard evidence it received, which contradicted policies, conclusions, and omniscience, needed to be dismissed. The English government of Neville Chamberlain already knew the truth. Most relevant of all, it knew that its staunchest critics needed to be marginalized and isolated. In fact, it portrayed the foremost of them as a bloodthirsty warmonger who was, if not truly senile, at best, morally or intellectually confused. That critic's name was Winston Churchill. Sadly, we have no Winston Churchills evident among us this evening. We have only Donald Rumsfeld's, demonizing disagreement, the way Neville Chamberlain demonized Winston Churchill. History and 163 million pounds of Luftwaffe bombs over England taught us all that Mr. Chamberlain had was his certainty and his own confusion, a confusion that suggested that the office can not only make the man, but that the office can also make the facts. Thus did Mr. Rumsfeld make an apt historical analogy, accepting the fact that he has the battery plugged in backwards. His government, absolute and exclusive in its knowledge, is not the modern version of the one which stood up to the Nazis. It is the modern version of the government of Neville Chamberlain. But back to today's omniscience. That about which Mr. Rumsfeld is confused is simply this. This is a democracy. Still, sometimes just barely, and as such, all voices count, not just his. Had he or his president perhaps proven any of their prior claims of omniscience about Osama bin Laden's plans 5 years ago, about Saddam Hussein's weapons 4 years ago, about Hurricane Katrina's impact 1 year ago, we all might be able to swallow hard and accept their omniscience as a bearable, even useful recipe of fact plus ego. But to date, this government has proved little besides its own arrogance and its own hubris. Mr. Rumsfeld is also personally confused, morally or intellectually, about his own standing in this matter. From Iraq to Katrina, to the entire fog of fear which continues to envelop this nation, he, Mr. Bush, Mr. Cheney, and their cronies have, inadvertently or intentionally, profited and benefited both personally and politically. And yet he can stand up in public and question the morality and the intellect of those of us who dare ask just for the receipt for the emperor's new clothes. In what country was Mr. Rumsfeld raised? As a child, of whose heroism did he read? On what side of the battle for freedom did he dream one day to fight? With what country has he confused the United States of America? The confusion we, as its citizens, must now address is stark and forbidding. But variations of it have faced our forefathers when men like Nixon and McCarthy and Curtis LeMay have darkened our skies and obscured our flag. Note with hope in your heart that those earlier Americans always found their way to the light, and we can too. The confusion is about whether this Secretary of Defense and this administration are in fact now accomplishing what they claim the terrorists seek, the destruction of our freedoms, the very ones for which the same veterans Mr. Rumsfeld addressed yesterday in Salt Lake City have so valiantly fought. And about Mr. Rumsfeld's other main assertion, that this country faces a, quote, new type of fascism, unquote, as he was correct to remind us how a government that knew everything could get everything wrong, so too was he right when he said that, though probably not in the way he thought he meant it. This country faces a new type of fascism, indeed. Although I presumptuously use his sign-off each night in feeble tribute, I have utterly no claim to the words of the exemplary journalist Edward R. Murrow. But never in the trial of 1,000 years of writing could I come close to matching how he phrased a warning to an earlier generation of us at a time when other politicians thought they and they alone knew everything and branded those who disagreed confused or immoral. Thus forgive me for reading Murrow in full. We must not confuse dissent with disloyalty, he said in 1954. We must remember always that accusation is not proof, and that conviction depends upon evidence and due process of law. We will not walk in fear one of another. We will not be driven by fear into an age of unreason if we dig deep in our history and our doctrine and remember that we are not descended from fearful men, not from men who feared to write, to speak, to associate, and to defend causes that were, for the moment, unpopular. When MSNBC management came into my office the next afternoon, it was not to fire me nor throw me into the back seat or the trunk of a car. The MSNBC president, Griffin, asked, "Could you do one of those every night? The ratings doubled." I told him, no, they should be done only when necessary. "Well, could you do one of those only when necessary?" I said he had a deal. It is correct to say the news media failed 20 years ago as this nation lied its way into Iraq. It is also correct to say, and I will go out on the egotistical limb to say it, that some of us tried.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. Whether it's a walk-off grand slam or a base hit to center field. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment. It's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Last season on the Choosing Sides F1 podcast, we established unequivocally that F1 is the pinnacle of motorsports.
Lily Herman, my co-host in season one, helped me choose a team, a driver, and then...
Well, we sent you on your jolly way.
Yeah.
I'm Tony Cam Brown, a tech, culture, and F1 commentator.
I'm Michael Costa, comedian, Daily Show correspondent.
And we're back with season two because, as it turns out, F1's newest fan is still a little...
dazed and confused.
Join us for season two of Choosing Sides F1 as we dive deeper into the rabbit hole of the pinnacle of motorsports.
Who makes money here?
What's CFD?
How do you manage a tire?
You, get back in there.
What are the rumors? What's the gossip? But you also know that someone's listening to your radio.
I'm going to pull up a picture of a tea cozy. I want to see what this thing looks like.
Are you going to be doing that accent this whole pod?
Listen to season 2 of Choosing Sides F1 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts,
or wherever you get your podcasts. You find it.
I'm Julian Edelman from Games with Names, and we're on a search to find the greatest games of all time. I'm talking Hall of Famers, MVPs, gold medalists.
I absolutely hate the Colts, bro. This game, I swear, led to the Deflategate.
Hey, guys, this ball's a little flat.
Ever wonder what a locker room feels like at a halftime of a Super Bowl?
Julian walking around, I'm pretty sure he had his shirt off for reasons I'm not sure. He was saying, gotta believe.
Oh, you gotta believe. From 18-1 with Eli.
Are you calling Bill just a cheater? Is that what you're saying right now?
He's looking for an advantage.
The 2004 ALCS with Big Pop.
The Red Sox in 2004 bounced back after the 3-0 in a winner chicken dinner, homie.
The immaculate reception with Terry Bradshaw.
Fired the ball. I hear the roar of the crowd. I never thought he caught the ball, but he did.
We're going to dive deep into the most iconic games with the most iconic people. New episodes dropping weekly. Listen to Games with Names on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Still ahead on Countdown, we'll continue this theme of history in the making, but switch it to sports. 4 weeks to the day that my full-time broadcasting career began, I had to cover for a 1,000-station radio network the tragic breaking news of one of baseball's most popular players, a man I had been cheering from the stands as a fan literally a month before, dying in a plane crash. On that happy note, first in each edition of Countdown, we feature a dog in need you can help. Every dog has its day. To Phoenix, not the city, but the dog. Spring Hill, Tennessee. We don't know how this happened to this tiny Yorkie, evidently from a breeder's, dumped in a field at barely a year old. He was healthy. He is not healthy now. Parasites, there's some blood in his cough. He's in intensive care at the animal hospital, but House of Strays Rescue is going all out to save his life. It already has a home lined up for him if he makes it. If you can donate, you can find him on Cuddly. That's Phoenix, F-E-N-I-X, or on my Twitter feeds. Your retweets would also help him. Thinking good thoughts for him can't hurt either. I thank you, and Phoenix thanks you. August 2nd, 1979 is now 43 years ago. And if I sound incredulous about that, it's because I'm incredulous about that. A certain part of me is always living back there on August 2nd, 1979, and the rest of that day is seared into my memory like my name and address. 1 month earlier to the day, July 2nd, 1979, I had been in the stands in my family's seats back of first base at Yankee Stadium in New York. A 20-year-old Yankees fan applauding Thurman Munson's RBI double and Lou Piniella's 2-for-4 day and Roy White's appearance, since Roy White was my mother's favorite Yankee player. But Munson particularly, he had been playing for the Yankees since I was 9, I was now 20, thus more than half my life. Now, on August 2nd, 1979, I was finishing the first month of my professional broadcasting career. It was my 7th or 8th solo shift anywhere for money. I was the nighttime sportscaster of United Press International's radio network, 1,000 stations worldwide, known as UPI Audio. For my first sportscast of the night, due to go at 5:45 p.m., I had long since finished my script. Tom Watson was leading round one of the PGA Golf in Michigan. The lawyer who owned Washington of the NFL, Edward Bennett Williams, he had just bought the Baltimore Orioles. There was an Expos Cubs matinee, a baseball game in Montreal, that prevailed through 3 rain delays. It was just about 5:43 p.m. Eastern time, and I was making the short walk from the little sports cubbyhole to the little main on-air studio in UPI World Headquarters in the Daily News Building, or if you saw the movie, the Superman Building on 42nd Street in Manhattan. I was just walking past the bank of thermal printers, each making their sluggish, muted, honking sound as they slowly printed stories out onto what wasn't really paper. There was the main UPI wire, the UPI sports wire, the UPI business wire, the UPI international wire, the UPI radio wire, several internal message wires via which the UPI bureaus around the world could communicate with headquarters in New York, or as it was abbreviated, NX. Those message wires were the 1979 equivalent of texting. As I got within a foot of these machines, one of them made a noise I had never heard before, a series of 10 really loud bells. As I moved over to see what the hell they could mean, the news editor Frank Rayfield came over to check as well. We saw the words simultaneously. We gasped simultaneously. Cleveland Bureau to NX, Thurman Munson, catcher captain, New York Yankees dead, piloting private plane, Canton Akron Airport 30. Still, it stuns me to read those words aloud. As soon as they finished printing, Cleveland sent it again. The bells went off again. I could see I now had about a minute until I went on the air. The editor pointed this out to me. You'll have to ad lib the sportscast, then come out here and do a voicer. Just talk about his career. Keep repeating that it's a bulletin, that he's dead, and that he was piloting a private plane. You know anything about him and planes? And I remember saying, oh, God, I do. And he said, well, use whatever you think fits. If more details come in, I'll bring them in to you. I'll try to get somebody at the airport for some sound. I don't remember anything of what I said on the air that night, nor in the special report, the voicer the editor had had me record as soon as I finished that live sportscast. It was all recorded. I never wanted to hear any of it. I never wanted to keep any of it. I have basically the rest of my career on tape. But I knew my youth was over right then. Thurman Munson had joined the Yankees when I was 9 years old, literally more than half my life ago. He was the first good rookie I ever saw added to my team. My family was convinced he looked like my mother's cousin, Billy. I met him a couple of times, had photographed him once, interviewed him once. He was gruff and forbidding, but I had never had a problem with him. What I knew about him and his plane, I spoke of as generically as possible. In my mind, I flashed back to lunch in the press room at Yankee Stadium 4 months earlier when I was still in college with my friend Rick Cerrone, the editor, not the catcher. Munson, Rick said, almost surreptitiously, leaning in toward me over the little table. Munson is flying his own plane back home to Ohio on, like, every day off. The Yankees are terrified. He's not as good a pilot as he thinks he is. Honest to God, one of the executives is trying to get George, that would be George Steinbrenner, the owner, to trade him to Cleveland just so he'll get out of the damn plane. They're all terrified he might wind up killing himself. I don't know how many special reports I did 43 years ago today, in addition to a new sportscast every hour. Later, a friend of mine from college who didn't even know I'd gotten the job as a sportscaster, I was so new there, told me he was driving in Buffalo, listening to the all-news station on the radio. He heard them say Munson had been killed, and with more, here's Keith Olbermann in New York, and he said he almost drove off the road because of the double shock. And I do know my boss, Sam Rosen, who did the morning shift and would have only gotten home from it around 1 or 2 p.m., he came back into the office to supervise things and to put together a long memorial special to feed that the 1,000 stations that used our stuff would all use. I was so glad to see Sam that day, and then he handed me a piece of paper. Those are the home phone numbers for Lou Piniella and Roy White. Call them. Try to do interviews. Be gentle. Record first, ask later. Like Munson, they had played in that game a month before. Really was my last as a fan. Roy White had been with the Yankees since I was 6 years old. Lou Piniella answered his phone, and somehow I asked him if he would talk to me for 2 minutes, and he did. And almost immediately, he burst into tears. There was such raw, immediate, brutal pain in his voice. I did the only thing I could think of. I said, listen, you should not have to do this all night. I will make copies of this interview and give it to the other radio networks so they will leave you alone. And only then did I think to ask my boss, Sam, who, by the way, still does the New York Rangers games on TV, if that was okay. And mercifully, Sam said it was a great idea. When I called Roy White, and Roy White was literally on the Yankees the day I became a Yankee fan, he begged me to tell him that they had discovered some kind of a mistake, that Thurman Munson was not dead. Both he and Pinella were blunt, but gentle and courteous. And I did make copies of the interviews, and I can see myself handing a cassette to a guy from NBC Radio named Mike Leventhal, who ran a kind of cartel, almost a black market, among New York radio sports reporters. Those interviews, the parts with Pinella and White, not me, were all over radio that day. I also remember discovering, after 3 or 4 hours of literally working nonstop, that I had never really known what that meant before. I remember I was supposed to be done at 11 p.m. That was the end of the shift, but I stayed until 1 a.m., and I just barely made the train, the last one of the night, back to my house. I remember my boss, Sam Rosen, talking to our stringer in San Francisco, a fellow named Rob Navius, and he said, "They're killing my team. I should go to Mexico and smoke myself blind." The things you remember at a time of stress and tragedy. In my youthful misunderstanding of how these things worked, I found myself coming back to the thought that I had somehow failed Thurman Munson by not telling somebody about that Yankee fear from April, that he was not as good a pilot as he thought he was. Although, even then, I asked myself, who were you going to tell? There are two postscripts to my story of the 20-year-old me covering the night Thurman Munson died. 20 years later, I was hosting baseball's Game of the Week on Fox, and I asked my producer what we were doing for the Munson anniversary. He asked, "What anniversary?" He was younger than I was. I had to explain it to him, even then. "You want to write something we can pre-produce, like a minute and a half?" Minute and a half. I did it. Didn't think much of it. A couple of years later, I was one of the public address announcers at Old Timers Day at Yankee Stadium, invited by the PR director, Rick Cerrone, same Rick Cerrone who, in April 1979, told me about Munson and the private planes and the Yankees' fears. It is a small world. The 25th anniversary of Thurman Munson's death was just days away. His widow, Diane, was there. We had never met. Then she saw me on the field and raced up to me and hugged me. "That piece you did on him. On the Game of the Week, when was it, 5 years ago? That was the best memorial I've ever seen to Thurman." We both teared up. I couldn't believe she said that. I told her about that night in 1979, what it had been like for me. I said I knew it was almost insulting to tell her, but I thought it was important somehow to share. She hugged me again. It was deeply moving, and it is still. The other postscript I only learned of last year. For forever, and the coincidence here with my friend and former boss Sam Rosen being the Hall of Fame announcer of the New York Rangers hockey team is extraordinary, but for forever, the reporter covering that hockey team, the Rangers, for the newspaper The New York Post has been Larry Brooks. I had forgotten, until last year, that the year that Thurman Munson was killed, Larry was a very, very young beat reporter covering not Rangers hockey, but Yankees baseball, and somebody sent me a clipping from the New York Post from Saturday, July 28th, 1979, 5 days before Munson's fatal plane crash. It is almost beyond belief. Larry Brooks's story began, quote, "Reports of Thurman Munson's death are exaggerated, at least slightly," unquote. Of course, he was using a metaphor. Munson's knees had been giving him trouble, and the manager of the Yankees, Billy Martin, was giving him more time off between catching assignments than usual. But Larry's story also included an even more jaw-dropping quote. Asked about the rumors he might not catch again this year, Munson said, "I don't know who started them. It was Martin." Asked after the game how his knees felt, he said, quote, "Sore. Real sore. Hey, you might be seeing my last hurrah," unquote. Larry says that since August 2nd, 1979, 43 years ago, that story has haunted him. Now it haunts me. Maybe it haunts you. I've done all the damage I can do here. Thank you for listening. Here are the credits. Most of the music was arranged, produced, and performed by Brian Ray and John Philip Schnale, who are the Countdown musical directors. All orchestration and keyboards by John Philip Schnale. Guitars, bass, and drums by Brian Ray. Produced by TKO Brothers. Other Beethoven selections have been arranged and performed by No Horns Allowed. The sports music is the Olbermann theme from ESPN2. It was written by Mitch Warren Davis, courtesy of ESPN Inc. Musical comments by Nancy Faust, the best baseball stadium organist ever. Everything else is pretty much my fault. That's Countdown for this, the 805th day since Donald Trump's first attempted coup against the democratically elected government of the United States. Arrest him now while we still can, or if as you listen to this, it's already happened, arrest him again while we still can. The next scheduled Countdown is tomorrow. Until then, I'm Keith Olbermann. Good morning, good afternoon, good night, and good luck. Countdown with Keith Olbermann is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. See for yourself when you sign up today and get $150 in bonus bets when you bet just $5. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply.
Last season on the Choosing Sides F1 podcast, we established unequivocally that F1 is the pinnacle of motorsports.
We did, but honestly, I was left with more questions than answers, Tony.
I'm Tony Karen Brown, a tech, culture, and F1 commentator.
And I'm Michael Costa, comedian from The Daily Show.
Join us for season 2 of Choosing Sides F1.
Our F1 102, if you will.
And get all of the answers.
All of them? Listen to Choosing Sides F1 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts,
or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.